heard a lot of very interesting systems biology talks, and before I was doing this, I guess I started wondering what is my place in the pantheon of all the different modeling you can do for biological systems, because we even come to the stage where you can do synthetic biology, make your own organisms, right? I'm always motivated by pictures like this. And I think many biologists are motivated by things that you can see in the microscope, right? Even though these cells have basically the same set of proteins inside, but a different composition, and give you very, very dramatically different morphology. So maybe the story that we should be thinking about when we look at a complicated genome, such as from a eukaryotic cell, is such as an alien coming down from another planet and just randomly pick up a book, such as War and Peace. You don't understand the language and you don't understand human culture. Well, what would you do? The first thing you would do is perhaps just start doing random cutting of this book and see whether you can find correlations between various different statistical correlations between the appearance of various different words. I think that's what bioinformatics do. But of course, that approach bypasses everything that that happens in language, right? So if I read this book, I understand what the book is describing because I've had this human experience of, you know, growing up and learning the language, not just the syntax, but also what they mean in terms of human interaction. And that, I think, is basically physics. Physics doesn't tell you what does happen, it tells you what could happen and what cannot happen, right? So by modeling this type of system, perhaps we can sort of have a deeper understanding of complicated books such as War and Peace, not just, you know, not just taking random pages and constructing what could come out of it. So I'm going to talk about work done with a bunch of collaborators. Jimmy is an excellent postdoc of mine. Who's done a lot of the simulation work that I'm going to describe. And the experimental collaborator that we're working with is Denny Wirtz, who's in the chemical engineering at Johns Hopkins. Most of the stuff I'm going to talk about is it's in a set of four papers that you can find published recently. Okay, so this talk is going to focus on the leading edge. So I'm going to talk about what are the leading issues at the edge. Right? So what are the things that you see at a cellular leading edge which are of interest? One, of course, the cell is always encased by the membrane, so the plasma membrane and the tension that's inherent in the plasma membrane has a strong influence on the cell morphology. Right? You cannot disregard the encasing effect of the cell membrane. And cell membrane itself is also a complicated object. It has membrane proteins in there. It's not even of a uniform lipid composition, and you see very interesting things just by doing very simple experiment. Here's an experiment which is done at Hopkins where you take a red blood cell and you fluorescently label aquaporin, right? And you just aspirate the cell by sucking it into a pipette. And what you see is that initially the cell has some spatial distribution of this membrane protein, aquaporin, but at some point later you see membrane protein, aquaporin, starts concentrating at the very tip of the aspirated cell. Why does that happen? Is there a reason for this dynamic reorganization? What are the roles of lipids in this process? The other thing that contributes strongly to the cell morphology, of course, is the cytoskeleton. We heard a lot about from Rich's talk, and he talked about essentially cytoskeleton outside of the moving object. I'm going to be focusing on the cytoskeleton inside the moving cell, and of course, for cells such as this picture here, this is a fish keratocyte, a fish skin cell. Cytoskeleton forms a very nice and uniform network inside the cell that propels this sort of leaf-like shape cell forward and maintain constant shape and velocity. And of course, cytoskeleton, because they're oriented filaments, they generate polarization immediately. This cell doesn't already broken symmetry. It has most of the filaments are oriented, pointing towards the leading edge. So that immediately breaks symmetry and allow you to have asymmetrical transport of various different intracellular signaling molecules or vesicles. Right? So that, of course, is an important aspect. And then in a very interesting paper that was in Nature last year, where you subject a cell to a drug, which then developed these very interesting blebs. These are membrane blebs, which is essentially you can think of the cell as a balloon, and then by removing attachment of the cell membrane to the cytoskeleton, you get these bubbles that come out due to internal pressure, right? So clearly, hydrodynamics plays an important role in here because the pressure is built up by cytosolic fluid. And there's discussion about how to think about this, essentially just porous environment where poroelasticity, which is something that's been used to model geophysical phenomena, is perhaps relevant here. And finally, receptor proteins, and this is something which many people talk about but don't really ever put in explicitly in the model. Receptor proteins, they're the first line of signaling. Basically, they sense the environment, and they, of course, live in the membrane, and they send signal to the surrounding, to the intracellular processes. So their physical properties, how they are organized, of course, completely influences everything that you see here. Is there any way to rationalize how they behave? So what kind of things that we do? Well, we like to model things happening at the leading edge, but of course, this is a work in progress, because we cannot incorporate many interesting physical processes that happen. But some of the issues we strive to include are the following. Well, first of all, equilibrium models of separate components, membranes, cytoskeleton, proteins, are available, right? So you can, many years of biophysics studying these different components, now there's pretty much well-established models for all these different components. What we like to do is to combine them in a dynamical non-equilibrium setting, which is a cell, right? We also have dynamical models for specific processes, such as the polymerization ratchet that was just mentioned, and also perhaps alternative force generation mechanisms that was just described in the last talk. So we like to include those two in the model to incorporate these sort of dynamical processes along with the various different components. Of course, the various different components interact with each other, and of course, this interaction is complicated. There's typically binding interaction that happens between various different proteins, but there's more than just that, right? There's also electrostatic interaction, long-range elastic interaction, which are not always very easy to include. And of course, these things are all essentially can be described in terms of regular physics language and mechanics, fluid mechanics, statistical mechanics. All right, so what I'm going to do is not going to show you the end product, but show you some examples that we've studied to show various different snapshots of the leading edge, and show what sort of dynamics are important, and perhaps motivate some of you to at least tell me what are the other important things, that interesting things that can be modeled using similar type of approaches. The things that we're going to describe are first cytoskeleton pattern formation, the leading edge of crawling cells. So this has to do with the picture that I showed earlier, where you have a uniform, very nice, regular network of cytoskeleton. How do you obtain such a beautiful and regular pattern? What are the underlying geometrical effects that give this pattern? The other example that I'm going to talk about is more dynamic. It has to do with phyllopodium protrusion, which is a bundle of cytoskeleton growing out of the cytoskeleton network. This, of course, has to do with the dynamics of the growing cytoskeleton, but also the flexible membrane. And we see that membrane here introduces some very non-trivial effects in the growth dynamics. And lastly, I'm going to talk about cell-virus interaction, which is another thing that could happen at the leading edge. So this has to do with a large cell interacting with a smaller, more rigid object. This has implications in cell virus infection and endocytosis. We'll show that some basic mechanical models of this process give you interesting predictions, which then you can go try to test out in the lab. And since this is more mathematical audience, I will also describe some basic methods involved in stochastic dynamics that may be of interest to some of you. Okay, so first example has to do with cell movement and the cytoskeleton network that's observed in the leading edge. So this is a picture of the fish keratocyte again. So this is a movie of the crawling cell. You can see it's very stable. It essentially maintains the same shape. In this picture, you can fix the cell and then take an EM photo of the leading edge. And this is a typical EM photo that you get from Pollard and Borzi's review article. You see that the cytoskeleton is not randomly oriented, it's actually oriented in some spatial pattern. And not only the cytoskeleton is oriented in some spatial pattern, the proteins associated with the cytoskeleton is also somehow distributed in a non-random fashion. So for a long time, this problem has been worked on. This is not a new problem. And what came out of this is this dendritic model, which can be used, which is a standard working model to understand how lamellar proteome fusion occurs. So I'm going to just go over this a little bit. Some of you might have seen this, but the basic element is that you have F-actin filaments which are pushing against the leading edge. So here's a membrane. And of course, there's some external signal that comes in that's received by presumably membrane proteins, which then initiates a chain of signaling process. For example, this protein, which is perhaps a G protein coupled receptor, will recruit other proteins such as other proteins and lipids, GTPases, PIP2 lipid protein, lipids, and then activate additional signaling proteins such as WASP and SCAR. And then these signaling proteins will then actually recruit additional proteins called ARP23. ARP23 is a very important player in this picture. Namely, ARP23 will generate new branches along the actin filament. So if you have an F filament growing in this direction, ARP23 binding to the filament will nucleate a new filament in a direction about 70 degrees from the mother filament. So that's what's happening in the leading edge. Of course, there's a whole recycling process that goes on. You have ATP hydrolysis process that's happening inside the filaments. This, of course, is an internal clock which allows you to then, which allows a protein such as profilin and cofilin to come in, and then re-sequester the actin monomers to resupply the leading edge. So the things which are very well known are these players. You know, we know the ARP23 is involved, and we know capping proteins involved. For example, you see at the tip of the growing filaments that there are capping proteins which terminate the growing filaments. We know the signaling proteins involved. So then the question is, how do you generate this very, very ordered actin cytoskeleton network that's seen? Not only the actin cytoskeleton network is very thin, the lamellar podium is actually a very, very thin organelle. So if you look from the side, even though you have a stochastic polymerization process is going on, the lamellar podium is actually only about 200 nanometers in thickness. What sets this length scale? So Borzi and Melli and Borzi did a very detailed study of the lamellar podium. They take the EM photo and they did image analysis. If you plot the orientation of the filament with respect to the leading edge normal, in other words, this angle alpha, for each filament, if you plot the angular distribution, you will get this binodal distribution where you have peaks around plus or minus 30 degrees. Now, in their story, they modeled the lamellar podium as basically essentially a flat two-dimensional object with no three-dimensional structure. And then, of course, you can think about the growth of these filaments trying to catch up to the leading edge. But the story which came into my mind is that, after all, you do have some thickness. 200 nanometers is not very large, but it's large enough to support a tree-like structure, right? So if you imagine that here's a mother filament, and I have ARP23 nucleating new filaments in all directions. In other words, actin filaments can grow out in every direction. Then I should get a tree, right? So just like a tree that you see outside in the courtyard, if I take that tree, and then I just project the direction of that tree onto a two-dimensional surface, which mimics this EM photo that you see here, then you should not get this double hump peak. You actually should get a a single peak distribution centered around zero. That's simply because you project filaments which come up out of plane down to in this direction. Even though these filaments are making 70 degree angle with a monofilament, they will be projected down to zero. Right? So if you did detailed simulation work of this three-dimensional network, allowing nucleation of the filament, growing of filaments in all directions, you will not get this pattern. You will get essentially a single peak around zero. So what gives rise to this very well defined plus minus 30 degree peaks? That was the question that we asked. So here's just the ArcGIS branching process in more detail. There are some structural studies already on ArcGIS. You can see that here is a mother filament. Here's a daughter filament. ArcGIS sits on the side. And ArcGIS can bind to any of the actin monomers. Remember, actin is essentially a helical braid of two protofilaments. So if I make a 70 degree angle with respect to the daughter mother filament, then I should, each one, if I can bind everywhere, then I should get this essentially a three-dimensional tree in all directions. And this geometry can be described by basically a geometrical relationship between the mother and daughter filaments, mimicking the ArcGIS structure. So we're going to try to model the situation using stochastic modeling, and we're going to ask exactly the question which I've already. So here's a summary of the questions we're going to ask. One is, why is the F-actin pattern seen? Even though it's a three-dimensional pattern, we actually see basically a two-dimensional distribution that we see here. Why is the molecular podium thin and flat? And how does the environmental signals translate to actin growth? What's not included in the model, which we heard from Rich's model talk, is many other important factors. So this is what's included in the model. This is actin polymerization, depolymerization is included, geometry of the membranes included, and its influence on the signaling proteins, as we'll see. The actin branching, ArcGIS branching initiation, and the precise geometry, and of course, capping of filaments. What's not included is some of the things we heard already about, so F-actin elasticity. We know that it's not a rigid filament. It actually can bend and distort. We don't also include cross-linking proteins. Focal adhesion is also left out. And of course, the mechanical feedback, which relates the mechanical force experienced by the cytoskeleton network to signaling is now modeled. And Forman, the actual force generation step, which we just heard, is not included. So it's just a direct pushing. And of course, at the moment, we have not included hydrodynamics. So the modeling done is basically taking experimentally known growth dynamics of actin filaments. And if you actually run down a differential equation for how actin polymerize, depolymerize, and everyone knows that actin, the pointed end has a different kinetic time scale, a polymerization time scale than the pointed end, you can actually write down a one kinetic equation for both of these ends. And if you solve this equation, you would just get a mean distribution, probability distribution of P. What's more interesting, I think, is that if you take this type of kinetic equation and do a stochastic simulation using a kinetic Monte Carlo scheme, you'll get individual filaments and their geometry in space. Right? So this is, for example, so this is just one filament. For a particular actin concentration, you'll see that it doesn't grow very much. Here's an actin concentration where it's at a critical concentration, you get trend milling. So the trailing edge depolymerization is favorable, and the leading edge, the polymerization, is favorable. So you get an end movement. How do you generate a network? Well, you can also do a typical you can also describe the branching mechanism using a differential equation, but this is misses geometry of the filament. In other words, you're going to get the nucleated density P, D of the daughter filament, but you're not going to get its spatial distribution. Right? So what we do is that we actually then generalize the stochastic kinetic Monte Carlo scheme that was described in the previous slide. It's basically the Gillespie algorithm, but now include geometry and spatial information of the branching process. So you can imagine I have a particular current geometry. I can ask at what location I can generate a new branch and include that in a kinetic Monte Carlo step, right? And this is a continuous time Monte Carlo step where the processes actually have the right order in time. So there's no, so it's more or less resembles what should really happen in the cell. We also include the excluded volume of the filaments. In other words, if you have a growing filament, if it runs into another filament, you cannot penetrate it. And we use basically no fitting constants because we know the rate constants of actin polymerization. These have all been estimated. Of course, in a model, we can play with these parameters, but when we started, we basically just used estimated parameters. So in this model, basically, there's no adjustable parameter. All right, so the first question, the first point I need to summarize is, how does membrane mechanics affect the problem? Well, if you just take a free membrane, and in fact, the mechanics of membrane is sort of understood, there are very well-established models which describes the bending fluctuations of the cell membrane. This essentially involves an energy term that goes like the bending constant multiplied by the mean curvature squared plus a surface tension term. So this is the Helfrich model for plasma membrane. This is not, I mean, this is very old, in fact. If you go back to the mechanics of elastic plates, in 1821, a French scientist named Sophie Germain already showed that the elastic energy of a plate should go like the mean curvature squared. Right? So that's sort of a 200-year history to describe things like this. So if you take a free membrane, you take this sort of a mechanical model, and you can ask, if I fold it over, just fold it over, what is this thickness I should get? Well, you can work it out very simply. You can just put in this geometry, and you minimize the energy with respect to the radius r, namely this leading edge curvature. You get out a length scale, and this is not surprising. This is a length scale. If you look at the dimensions of this problem, kappa divided by gamma square root has a scale of length. And you find that the radius, the optimal radius that minimizes the energy is just 50 nanometers. That means that this thing is 100 nanometers thick. You just take a free membrane and fold it over. Right? Take a sheet, you fold over, it should just fall into this thickness. This is kind of surprising to me because we know that this lamellar podium essentially has its thickness on that order. Right? It's not much bigger than 100 nanometers. That means that the growth at up to three branching is not, and growth of filaments is not happening at all in this region, namely away from the leading edge. Only happening at the very tip of the curve region, the leading edge. Right? So that was kind of strange to me because if you think of proteins as free diffusing proteins in the cytosol or in the membrane, you should get growth everywhere. Why is it you have localization of growth right at the very tip of this curve region? Now we came up with this sort of explanation. This is a possible explanation. It doesn't mean it's actually true, but the explanation has to do with the fact that if you have a signaling protein, such as G-protein-coupled receptor, it lives in the membrane. It does not have to have a regular geometrical shape. And you can imagine it can have some sort of asymmetrical shape looking something like this. And due to the strong hydrophobic interaction between the surface of the protein with the rest of the membrane, the protein actually generates a local curvature, a local curve region. It says that the membrane should contact my surface with a particular geometry, essentially looking like this. So that angle is described by this angle psi here. So now let's just compare. You take this simple assumption, you compare the situation where you insert this protein into a flat membrane versus a curved membrane, and you compute the solvation energy. And you can compute the solvation energy very easily using thermodynamic arguments involving membrane protein interaction energy, membrane creation of a hole in the membrane, and then of course the additional bending energy of the membrane. Notice that the only thing that depends on curvature is actually these pieces. And you can actually try to compute what the solvation energy is, namely these free energies, F1 and F2, going from this geometry to this geometry. And again, the energy will depend on this angle psi, namely the geometry of the protein itself. If you do that calculation, and you can do that in many different ways. You can do it using a finite element discretization of the membrane, putting the membrane protein of a shape looking like this, essentially a wedge, not a cube. Cube will be a symmetrical case with psi equal to zero, but a wedge will give you psi, give you psi that's different from pi over two. So here's this solvation energy as a function of the imposed curvature of the membrane. In other words, I can try to, you know, make the membrane curve with some radius curvature 1 over r, given this axis here. And then I can compute what is the energy cost for me to insert a membrane protein into that region at the very tip. And you get the plot looking like this. So for a perfectly flat membrane, for a perfectly symmetrical protein, that's psi equal to pi over 2, you get solvation energy which goes like this. But if you introduce some asymmetry for the protein, then you find that the solvation energy looks lower, right, in absolute value. And not only that, if you look at delta-delta mu, in other words, for fixed membrane curvature, you compare the solvation energy of the protein for different geometries, the energy difference can be quite large, up to 10 kT. Right? So what does that suggest? That suggests that if I am a protein of a particular geometry here, let's say I'm a protein with geometry pi over 2 minus 25 degrees, then I would preferentially migrate, if I sit in the flat, so this flat membrane, that with the radius of curvature equal to infinity, so 1 over r is equal to 0. If I sit over here, I see that I can actually lower my energy by going to a region with a radius of curvature of 39, or 1 over 39. Right? So that means if I've given a choice, the probability for me to see over here is e to the minus 5, e to the plus 5 larger than the probability of me seeing in a flat region. So that suggests that if I have proteins, receptor proteins, the GPCRs, which initiate the whole signaling process, if it's freely diffusing everywhere, if I have a curve region, it will just completely concentrate in that region due to completely mechanical reasons. Right? You can ask whether this actually happens in a thermodynamic system. Well, this is actually a simulation that we've done. You take a finite element representation of membrane, and you put some bunch of membrane proteins in there, and this is very low concentration of membrane protein, and then you artificially pull out a membrane tether, you find that all these proteins start to aggregate at the tip of the tether. Right? In fact, the coverage at the very tip of the membrane, where the curvature is high, is 3 times higher than the coverage in outside this region. So this is very reminiscent of that picture I showed from the very beginning, where you have this aspirated red blood cell, where you start getting accumulation of proteins at the tip of the aspirated pipette. All right, so this is a completely mechanical explanation. So what happens now if you now build in this spatial distribution of membrane proteins in the filament cytoskeleton growth process? Well, here's the hypothetical geometry. So no one knows what the structure of this is at the membrane leading edge, but you can imagine you have this protein here, and then of course it recruited WASP, which then additionally recruited OCT2-3 protein, and then because the membrane this transmembrane protein is concentrated at the leading edge, you can now define the geometry of the branching process. In other words, I can define according to the normal vector at every point the leading edge of the protein, define an orientation of the OCT2-3 molecule, and we know what the OCT2-3 molecule more or less look like, right? So that's defined here. And then you have a geometrical process of converting the OCT2-3 orientation to the daughter filament orientation, right? So that's that mathematical relationship which I described earlier, involving conversion of the direction of the mother filament to the daughter filament. So that's all built in. And then because OCT2-3 is tethered to the membrane protein, now this point is intricate, but it's actually not as difficult to explain as I first thought. If you have this membrane protein that's tethered, of course, it cannot possibly tumble and reorient its orientation to space anymore. Its orientational distribution is restricted. In other words, I can describe its orientation using a probability distribution P as a function of theta phi omega. The details may not be so appetizing, but the point is that you can specify the orientation of this molecule using three variables, three angular variables, basically oil angles. And then imagine now you have a filament growing somewhere near in the vicinity of this octet 3 molecule. And of course, octet 3 would like to nucleate a new branch with this filament. But you see that you cannot really nucleate a new branch unless the geometry is compatible. In other words, the orientation of this octet 3 molecule is compatible with the orientation of the growing filament. For example, here, if the filament is going this direction, then the octet 3 should not be able to bind to the filament in any high probability.
Sean,
yeah.
My argument is that
it's tethered to the membrane, so they cannot. So the
fluid membrane.
That's right. So that's why we describe this as using a probability distribution, which is very broad. So you see in a moment.
Well, why does it have a bias at all?
The curvature of the surface
that's
talked about.
That's why I mentioned not.
So there's some average orientation, n is not.
It's actually not.
Yeah, so you define everything with respect to the normal vector n. What does that mean mathematically in our stochastic model? What you can do is that you can just model this process by multiplying the branching process of the rate constant k plus with this additional probability distribution, which then of course depend on the local geometry of the leading edge. So that's what we did. And that's what you get out of the picture. You get I'm showing you the end result. I'm not telling you actually what went into getting this. What you get is that you have a growing network that looks like this. This is, of course, a stochastic simulation. So the thing that come out of it, we can see which filaments are capped and which filaments are still growing. We can also see where the branch occurs, and we can project it down to the two-dimensional surface and start doing statistics. And that's what we did. So here's the comparison. If you in these plots, the dotted line is an experimental distribution obtained from Mehle and Borzi's paper, and then the solid line is very different probability distributions that we tried. In other words, it's that P of theta phi omega that went into this the branching rate constant. Right? So if you have no restriction, namely up to three can orient everywhere, you get a completely flat distribution, just as I described earlier. That you should not have any directional bias at all within this melopodium. If you constrain theta near some value, so this constraint actually is much less severe than you imagine. We actually take a probability distribution which is covering, so theta can go from 0 to 2 pi. The probability distribution, even though it's constrained near theta, it actually covers from minus pi to pi. Right? So you don't constrain. You don't actually just make a very narrow constraint. You just say that the membrane introduces the bias enough that it only cut off half the possible orientations. Right? And that already is enough to generate the patterns that look very much like experiments. And if you change the geometry of octet 3, in other words, let's say the octet 3 is bound where it's an angle that's stated near 45 degrees oriented away from the leading edge, and then you get something that's different. Right? So now we're getting some information about what this receptor complex looked like at the moment of nucleation, if you like. In other words, if it's not oriented in the right way, you're not going to get the same cytoskeleton network that you observe. And we see that theta is the most important variable. The other two angles are not very important.
And the experimental data is well obtained?
I'm sorry?
The experimental data is well obtained?
Experimental data is, it's from Kerosite EM photos.
And isn't this a bit circular? I mean, you're setting the angle to achieve the angle. I mean, I guess I'm missing the data.
So this data is actually not the direction of the filaments. This data is actually the orientation of the receptor complex prior to, right? So in other words, in a way, you can sort of describe it in a way that you have, namely that you need to have the right orientation to nucleate filaments in the right direction. Otherwise, you will get the wrong distribution. Right. But of course, why you get this right vision. We're proposing that it's because of the tree that actually tethered to the filament, and then you have tethered to the membrane protein, which then is spatially localized. Okay, so this is a long story, but anyway, you can do additional studies. You can play with this network. How does this pattern robust with respect to parameters? You can try to vary the various different distribution that you go. You see that only certain combination of the distribution theta and phi will give you the observed distribution. So G here denotes a good agreement on experimental data. F denotes something that's completely failure to denote agreement. So you have some ranges which can be perhaps measured in experiment, in a careful experiment. But of course, this type of, it turns out that our model is quite sensitive to these type of parameters. There are other information that can be obtained. You can of course play with the parameters that we described, the rate constants and the Kappian rate constants, and so on. And you see that the dendritic network actually do depend, the morphology of the distribution do depend on the parameters in a non-trivial way. For example, if you increase capping, if you increase the capping rate, you tend to destroy this pattern that you see. If you increase the OP2-3 rate, you get very, very fine dendritic structures, which does not look at all like the experimental observation. And finally, this is something which was a bit discouraging to us. It turns out that volume exclusion is also important. In other words, if I turned off this constraint where filaments running into another filament has to stop growing, and I allow it to penetrate through each other, you also don't get the right distribution, which is somewhat discouraging in the sense that if you imagine that these filaments can actually fluctuate, then this volume exclusion between the filaments is very difficult to describe in a phenomenological model. So this turns out to be sort of an important thing. So what is this? How can we learn from this simulation? Well, here's a plausible scenario which could it's not a mathematical model, but it's a model that summarizes some of the things that we've learned. One is that you have these receptor proteins which, in a typical situation with a spherical cell, should be more or less equally distributed. But as soon as the cell attaches to substrate, then you see that you automatically will get high curvature regions where to start concentrating these receptor proteins at the curved regions, right? And of course, now if you receive any external signals, then you can only start polymerizing filaments near where the receptor proteins are. So curvature already dictates that you can only polymerize right near the substrate. And of course, this is a self-feedback thing. If you keep protruding, you get a thin lamellipodium that further concentrates receptor proteins. And then that persists, and you get this very stable, flat lamellipodium that keeps growing. This is something that we're trying to further corroborate using our simulation technique. Okay. Now, what I described about receptor protein is in membrane also has other interesting implications. Right? So, if you take a lipid vesicle and you embed it, so this is actually not a biological problem, but a more of a just interesting nanotechnology problem. Yeah.
How do you explain the difference between lamellipodia and filopodia?
Well, the filopodia would be the situation where you have bundling active filaments, cross-linking active filaments, and that growth will generate a bundle, which then can protrude very stably against the membrane. So here, in the lamellipodium, you would say the bundling protein is somewhat absent. Therefore, you only get these single filaments, which then cannot, protrude stably because they'll buckle mechanically. So in our simulation, we have not really included cross-linking proteins, so we cannot observe the formation of filopodia, if you like.
But if I start in the, if you start in your simulation with a lamellipodial geometry,
if you you start with simulation with a Philipodio geometry, we just keep growing until we reach the buckling length, and then we just buckle.
So how does the cell decide whether to form a Philipodio or a Velopodio?
That's a very good question. I don't think I have a good answer for that. There are some hypotheses out there. One has to do with again protein related forming these capping proteins, which then bundle together, which then make essentially concentrate filaments in the same direction. Right? These are very open questions. Actually, there's other discussions about, you know, if you have sufficiently dense actin filaments and they start running into each other, then you have spontaneous. So very, I hate to use the word, similar to liquid crystalline type of things, which then they collide and they form, you know, same orientation. Right? But it's unclear to me that the filaments are of sufficient density to see the latter in a typical amino protein. Anyway, this story here has to do with nanotechnology. You take a lipid vesicle, start embedding proteins with the asymmetrical geometry which I described. Then you see that there's actually thermodynamic force, driving force, for you to phase separate into two smaller vesicles. And again, it has to do with the story of salvation energy of these proteins. You can compute the phase diagram in this system. I won't go into it, I'm running out of time. So, but if you like to make vesicles of certain size, you can see that you can perhaps design this process using proteins of appropriate geometry or nanoparticles, if you like. And here it's just a simulation that we've done, and you see that these transmembrane proteins actually stabilize this peanut shape, right? Precursor to phase separation. All right, so this is Philipodia, and I'm not going to. So you already asked a question on this. I'm not going to go into how they're formed. I'm going to discuss what the role of membrane in generating this type of protrusion and how they affect the observed protrusion speed. So one thing that you see here is that Philipodia, so this is actually immune. We knock out capping, right? So we have no capping. The only way it can do is it can grow, is keep growing. And then here you see you have these long thin needles that protrude. At some point they start to buckle due to mechanical instability, and then they disappear. So these are again actin bundles. You can also make the same arguments about membrane restoring force. It turns out you can compute using membrane mechanics again to compute what the radius of the Philipodia membrane enclosure should be. It should be on the order of again 50 nanometers in radius. This is, you can also compute what the restoring force that the membrane is exerting on this growing bundle is on the order of 13 piconewtons. This is essentially a membrane tether, inverted tether. There's some work done previously on pulling a membrane when you generate these tethers. This essentially, you invert the process by pushing from the inside. And you can actually try to compute the protrusion process using a sophisticated statistical mechanics process model. It turns out that you have to describe the fluctuation of the very flexible membrane using a complicated Fokker-Planck equation. What we've done is that we converted this to a Markov model. There turns out to be a mapping between this Fokker-Planck equation to a Markov model. If anyone's interested, I can describe this. But here, I think I'll just skip it. And at the tip, of course, is where all the interesting physics is. And we don't know what's really happening at the tip of the Philipodia. It appears that there's some inner vast proteins which are at the tip of Philipodia. So what we do in this model is that we do not model active protrusion, such as what's been talked about in Dickinson's talk. We actually just model passive protrusion, right? So you generate a space with the intercalation of monomers via thermal fluctuation. Of course, it can still be attached via membrane protein such as performin, but we're saying that there is no active generation of space. There's only an attachment energy, which goes something like this as a function of space, right? So U is function of Z Lagrange. So here is if you have a force here, U of Z looks something like this, linear function. Here if you assume a passive spring here, then it would just be a quadratic function. And that defines our problem assiduously. And then you find something very interesting. So if you carry out the calculation, you'll find that if you take a rigid membrane, you increase the membrane bending constant to physical values, you find the protrusion speed is small by at least a factor of 2. Right? So flexible membrane does something very interesting, and this has to do with the collective effect of filaments essentially supporting each other. What happens is that you have growing filament, and if you have a small space that's opened by membrane fluctuation or even active processes, then you stabilize this protrusion step via monomer addition, and then you see the rest of the membrane has no choice but to create new space for the rest of the filament. Right? So that step, even though this is somewhat rare, but this rare step generates a large velocity, which then increases your protrusion speed quite substantially. And the other effect, which is something that's sort of interesting, is that the protrusion speed also depends on the number of filaments in the bundle. So this would not be the case if you actually take a rigid membrane or take a filament bundle growing against a rigid obstacle. Then you'll find and you assume certain geometry between the filament, or if you say the filament are aligned in the right manner, then you'll find that the growth of the bundle actually depends on how many filaments I actually have in the bundle. But I'm not explaining this very well. What I'm trying to say is that due to membrane flexibility, there is also a dependence on the number of filaments in the bundle, which is not as strong in a more rigid obstacle. So if you have a rigid obstacle, then the dependence, the speed of the function number of filaments is much less dependence than what's shown here.
Experimentally, the onset, I always thought they were roughly constant velocity.
Right. So experimentally, I think there's some experiments that's being carried out. I have not actually seen published data on this, protruding against rigid objects. It turns out that the dependence of that slope depends on the detailed or geometrical arrangement of filaments with respect to each other in the bundle. And that's usually not known in these problems. So we actually have exact results associated with that. But due to the absence of data, we haven't looked at this. So where were we trying to go with this? Well, clearly we would like to actually take this model that we described with flexible membrane with protruding bundles underneath to describe actually what happens in the real cell where you have these branch network. This actually turns out to be a much more difficult problem than we first anticipated. And there are very interesting dynamics that's seen at the leading edge of cells, right? So here's a fibroblast cell. You can see that at the tip here, you have this ruffle that's developing. Well, how do you actually explain this? Clearly, you have to combine mechanics of the filament with the fluctuating membrane, which is then exerting a force on the filaments, and then perhaps even moving fluid right underneath the filaments. This was, I guess, the initial motivation of Gaimto's work. What I'm telling you is that we actually are not there to explain this, but we'd like to understand this at some point. I'll skip this, actually. This is a more one. So, running out of time, I will talk about the last piece of thing that we did. It has to do with viral entry into host cells, and this story has to do again with the cytoskeleton. It turns out that if you look at these EM photos of virus attaching to, let's say, a T cell, you'll find that there are receptor proteins on the surface of the T cell which bind to what's called the glycoproteins on the surface of the HIV part. So these glycoproteins, and the concentration of glycoproteins is known, on the order of 220 proteins on the surfaces of an HIV virus. And these proteins associated with multiple proteins on the surface of the cell, CD4, CCR5, forming a contact zone. Right? So some single molecule experiments that were being performed by Danny Wirtz, he wanted to look at how single virus actually invade a typical cell. So So what occurred to us very quickly is that if you actually take into account the energetic requirement forming the contact zone, then something strange or something very a large scale movement should happen very quickly. In other words, if you look at the energetics of the process, so what, without even thinking of a dynamical growing cytoskeleton network, just think of the static mechanics problem, you'll see a dramatic shape change when the virus sits on top of the cell. And this has to do with the fact that if you look at the contact energy, namely energy is a function of the contact area, it should, if I take a virus and if it go into the cell with depth h, you see that this contact energy increases, contact energy decreases with increasing h. Right? So if you bury yourself deeper, I can make more contacts with the cell. Therefore, that's a favorable process. But there are things resisting this movement, namely the membrane energy. In order to actually go into the cell, you need to distort the membrane. That energy is going up if you increase h. And of course, there's an actin cortex that's at the surface of the cell. And if you want to enter the cell with generate this indentation with high h, the actin cortex energy also goes up. It's an elastic substrate. Of course, it resists any deformation that happens at the surface. Well, it turns out that you can make a very simple estimate incorporating all those energies in a problem, and you actually get an analytical formula of what the engulfment depth is. So the common thinking was that the actual process of viral entry has to do with additional proteins coming on, engulfing the virus. But if you take this mechanical estimate, incorporating the membrane elastic energy here, and the mechanical energy of deforming the cytoskeleton, so this actually turns out to be a Hertzian contact problem, which you can solve with small deformation approximation exactly. You get this energy dependence as a function of h. So the engulfment depth and E as a function of engulfment depth. And you find something pretty surprising, namely for physiological contact adhesion energies, namely, let's say that you have, each glycoprotein forms a bond on the order of 5 to 10 kT per receptor, and you have 116 glycoproteins, you can compute the adhesion energy as a function of adhesion energy per unit area, A, and that number is on the order of 0.05 to 0.15, depending on what the binding energy is. Right? You take that number, and then you take in the Young's modulus. So here, embedded in here, is the Young's modulus of the cell, which is on the order of 10 kilopascals. And then if you actually look at the energy, the function engulfment depth, you see that for very reasonable adhesion energies, you get that the cell is already engulfed essentially completely. So here, depth is 70 nanometers, which is more than the radius of the cell. Right? So by contact energy alone, the cell should be already sinking into the cell. The virus should be already sinking into the cell. This opens a very interesting question, right? So exactly what is the chicken and egg question in viral entry? Is it because the virus is already engulfed, then you have other protein to come that recognizes the highly curved region and then take the particle inside, or is it the other way around? In other words, protein come in, recognizes the virus, and then engulfs it. So at least from mechanical energy estimates alone, you see that the engulfment happens without any external help. Again, so that's something that due to this, you know, since the estimate is so simple, you can actually try to estimate the force. It's actually pretty large. If there's a suction force on the order of 45 piconewtons, this can be measured at AFM. So the prediction is now being checked out in experiments. And perhaps, you know, the contact geometry that's predicted by this very simple model shows that shows that curvature sensing proteins could recognize this engulfment and then facilitate additional membrane fusion and engulfment of viral particle. So this still awaits experimental verification, but it's a model which is a simple estimate which is quite provocative. Anyway, so I think it's a good time to conclude. I think I only gave you some basic, essentially a preliminary work that we were doing in the area of modeling leading edges itself. We have not, you know, investigated all possible phenomena at this length scale, but clearly there are already very interesting dynamical things that you can say about what's happening in the leading edge. And it has to do with mechanics of various different constituent parts, the geometrical shape of membrane proteins, and the various cytoskeleton associated proteins that mediate these processes. So I hope this will be a starting point of a good research program, and I thank your attention.